Welcome to the Mac Jury. This is the home of truth, justice, and the Macintosh way. I'm Chuck Joyner, and we've got a fun panel for you this time around, folks. This time, we're going to examine the issues around school tech, what kids need, what they're using, what they want to go back to school, to be educated, to educate them. We're going to try to come at it from pretty much every angle. And we have a unique mix, I think, this time around. First up, Pat Falquet is back. Pat, it's good to have you.
Hi, I'm Pat. I do MacMouseCalls.com. I work with Bob Levitis on Dr. Mac Consulting. But in this case, my claim to fame is I am the 1995 Virginia Technology Teacher of the Year. Our school that I was working with at that time became the first Apple Distinguished School. I got my award from Steve Woz himself. Even though my five children are out of school, I've got seven grandchildren who are either starting school or will soon are in school or soon starting school. And technology and education is a real subject with me.
Great. Well, it's good to have you. And congratulations, just a few years belated on the award. But that's perfect. That's perfect. Folks, this Mac Jury also has a distinctly international flavor, since we didn't think that school tech and education tech was just limited to the United States. So joining us from down under, Mr. Keith Lang. Keith, it's good to have you as always.
Thanks, Chuck. It's great to be here. And yeah, there are some schools outside of the US, which is an interesting factoid for your listeners. People might know me as one of the guys behind Skitch, which is a fun desktop and web sharing app. And also before that, I was part of Plask, which made applications like Comic Life, which is used very, very heavily across schools around the world. So a fair bit of experience with education.
Indeed, indeed. Next up, coming back to the United States, Mr. Julio Jose de Zapata. Julio, it's always a pleasure to have you back.
Hey, Chuck. It's always a pleasure. I'm a technology writer at the St. Paul Pioneer Press here in Minnesota. I write a tech column, you know, not unlike Andy and Atko's column. And I'm a tech book writer on the side. My current project is an iPad-related book, and the thrust of the book is how the iPad is useful both in business and education. So it's not a how-to book. It's more of a more kind of a tech trend kind of a book. And you can find me at ojezap.com.
Okay, and a couple things. First of all, I believe you just did an article for the St. Paul Pioneer Press about this very topic.
Yeah, every year for the paper, I write a. It's mostly college focused, and I sort of discuss the best options for college kids, you know, heading back to campus, and what you know their parents should consider buying for the kids. Always with the caveat that they should first check to see what the university requires, but then beyond that, you know, what are some of my recommendations, which for some reason tend to be kind of Mac centric.
I can't imagine. And we should make one final note for you. You're not satisfied with writing and doing all this stuff. You have to test things all the time. So you're in a little bit of a different Skype setup tonight with us.
Yeah, I've got the USB portion of the iPad camera kit hooked in to my iPad here. And then I have a USB mic hooked into that, and I'm running the iPhone Skype app. There's no iPad Skype app, but the iPhone Skype app works just fine. I'm rather amazed at the audio quality over Wi-Fi. It's quite good.
Yeah, you're coming through very well. So if we do hear you hiccup, we'll know that's why, but at the moment it sounds terrific.
Yeah.
Next up, one of the biggest kids I know, Mr. Jeff Gamet. Jeff, it's always fun.
You're far too kind. And thanks for having me on yet again. And for those people that don't know who I am, Jeff Gamet, I'm the managing editor for Mac Observer. I also write for InDesign Magazine, Layers Magazine, Photoshop Magazine, Design Tools Monthly. There's something else in there I can't remember, probably.
I'll have it in the show notes, Jeff.
Oh, good. You've got my back, and I appreciate that. And I also do the We Have Communicators podcast, Apple Context Machine podcast, and Design Tools Weekly podcast in all my spare time. And I think I'm qualified to be on the jury today for two reasons. First, I actually showed up. And second, I went to school once.
That's close enough in your case.
That's right.
Okay, and last up, and absolutely last but not least, the gentleman who is the guy who has helped me, or no, scratch that, has redesigned all of the Mac Voices Group websites, both from a design standpoint and some of the technical aspects, my buddy, Mr. Eric Bernskield. Eric, it's a pleasure to have you for the very first time on the Mac Jury.
Thanks for letting me come on.
It's great. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm a web designer. I'm a young web designer, so I think that's what's qualifying me to be here, because I'm the kid in the mix, I suppose. But I'm a web designer and software trainer. I run my thing over at Bernskild Media, where I do tutorials and web design.
So, folks, I went out and I found a real-life kid to talk to as part of this deal. So that's pretty important. And Eric, we also want to let folks know that you are a little bit east of me and north of Keith.
Yes, I'm in Sweden.
What part of Sweden?
Westport, Gothenburg.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have cool. We have international, we have a kid, we have an award-winning educator. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm just asking the questions. Pat, though, I'm going to start out with you since you really are probably the closest thing we have to a serious voice of authority here. Any particular thoughts on what kids need right now going back to school? Things have changed so much from the time that any of us, with the exception of Eric, went to school. It's a whole different world out there. A lot of things kids want, but what do they need?
Well, you know, it really depends upon the teachers and the educators that you, or administrators that you talk to. Unfortunately, even some of our youngest teachers see themselves as being the presenter of all knowledge. And of course, there's another role, and that is to be the facilitator of knowledge. And to have the kids be the producer of media that exhibits the knowledge that they have gained. I worked in the elementary environment, and as far as I'm concerned, every child needs a computing device at their desk all day long, because I think that that's the best way in today's world to educate children. But if you talk to a textbook producer, they're going to say they need textbooks, and they're probably going to say they need paper in their hands. So it's going to be interesting to see what some of the rest of you say. And for Comic Life, we use that. It's a great program. Once again, it allows the kids to produce products with the knowledge that they gain.
Pat, that's an interesting perspective, and of course, I detect just a little cynicism there with regard to the paper textbooks, although I'm not sure I disagree with any of it. But you're advocating producing media, and that's something that, you know, in a media-rich world, I guess it's completely natural. Keith, you produced one of the pieces of software, helped produce one of the pieces of software that Pat was talking about. How do you feel about the requirement of computer hardware for kids?
I have to agree with Pat that to me it's a case of kids spend their lives consuming media. You know, they watch cartoons and movies and computer games, and it is completely unbalanced if they don't have access to those tools to make their own media. So to me, it's obviously really essential that kids have access to these tools, and so they can tell their own stories instead of just hearing everybody else's stories.
Interesting.
It's only when you produce something yourself that you know that you've synthesized the material and you understand it in order to make something from what you've learned.
I want you in here, especially now, because you are clearly a doer. That's the way, one of the ways you learn. I'm not sure if you learned that as part of your educational system or just on your own, but Do you think that it's should be a hardware requirement kind of thing at this stage of the game?
I definitely do. I mean, we at our school, we don't really get computers. We have computer labs, but not really our own laptops. And I think that's a big minus. You could do so much more being able to learn how to produce at a higher level in school.
Okay, Jeff, compare this discussion to when you were in school. Because I know, you know, to get access to a computer when I was in school, well, first of all, there weren't computers as we know them now. There were what we would consider computing devices, but you had to be part of a very special elite. In fact, it really wasn't part of the mainstream curriculum.
No, actually, it wasn't. I remember when I was lucky enough to finally get involved in computer programs in high school, it was done through recommendations through the math department. And we before we could even take the various computer classes, and there was only a very small handful of classes, we were expected to go and take a semester of typing, because the thought at the time was knowing how to do standard IBM Selectric typewriter typing was a necessary skill to code, which I disagree with. However, now that I write all the time, having spent a little bit of time learning how to do touch typing actually has worked out in my favor. Who would have thought I actually am using something I learned in high school? But when I was a senior in high school, I was actually able to get it was Franklin Ace 1000, which was an Apple IIe clone computer. And that completely changed education for me, because I went from having to deal with just regular textbooks and then typewriters or handwritten pages to being able to use the textbooks in conjunction with the computer. And then I was able to create content myself and actually learn a lot faster. So I agree with Pat. Having that constant access to computers can be a very valuable tool. And going into college, I was the most popular person in my dorm because I had a computer and everyone wanted to come over and do all of their papers on my computer. And it's just continued on since then. So anytime I've been involved in any type of educational situation, having access to a computer, and then now computers where I can do research online in real time and then collaborate with people in real time, has been just an incredible benefit.
You make me laugh, because I too took typing in high school. I was one of two guys in the typing class.
Yeah, I was one of two guys in my typing class, and the other guy that was there was for the same reason, not because we wanted to learn how to type, but because we had to do our time in the barrel to be able to get into the computer classes.
Well, I see, we didn't have Apple IIs, so for me it was a great way to meet girls.
You're just a wild man.
Julio, you're the guy that's sitting there with an iPad talking to us over Skype. So where does the iPad fit into the hardware requirements? Are we at a stage already that might supplant a laptop or a desktop machine, or is it not quite there yet?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been doing some research on various universities that are integrating the iPad into their student curricula, and it's all over the map. There are some schools that are giving students a choice. You can have a laptop or an iPad. Other schools assume that students already have laptops, which is a pretty good assumption, and just hand out iPads. But just today, Seton Hill University, I think it's called, in Pennsylvania, interviewed the president of that university, and they're doing something really interesting. They're actually giving, not just lending. They're giving every student at the school a MacBook and an iPad. And not only that, I mean, they were sort of tech aware up to this point, but they hadn't really implement it very much that was techie, but they did a whole revamp. So they're putting a whole technology infrastructure in place with better Wi-Fi, better wired, an Apple certified repair facility on campus, MacBooks, iPads, and the logic with doing both the MacBook and the iPad, the logic with that is they assume the laptop is the content creation device primarily, and the iPad is the content consumption and communication device, because the assumption is the students will have their iPads with them at all time, and therefore it'll make for a more close-knit student body because communication will be so much improved. So, you know, very, very interesting case study.
Now that I find that really intriguing, Julio, that, and that's just one school district. I understand that, but every night on the news, you know, I'm seeing these horror stories about school districts asking parents to pay for soap and for toilet paper, and then there are other school districts that are out there handing out iPads and MacBooks, and of course, then we have the school districts that are putting down AstroTurf in the football stadium. There seems to be a lot of inconsistency here with where the priorities are along with what can be funded. And I don't know if there's anything to say that. Pat, do you get any feedback on that? Because you were in a teaching environment. That's got to be a constant struggle.
You know, it is. First of all, Seton Hall is a university, and it's a private university. So through student fees and grants and all sorts of things there, they're funding that. When I was at Gunson Elementary, which is where I did most of my educational work, we simply didn't have what we needed. So, first of all, I was a parent volunteer. I'm not a teacher, but my work with the computer teacher caused them to, you know, caused the state of Virginia to recognize me. We wrote grants to get the money we needed. Now, remember, this is in the mid-1990s. We raised $3 million to provide additional computers and software and things like that for the school. From one grant, we ended up with getting about $7 million over the course of about 10 years in order to have the technology that we wanted. So you'll find that many schools are using grants and parent raising, money raising activities to provide the niceties, which I think are probably the necessities. It's interesting. Many districts don't get it. In fact, I found one thing that I would like to read to you real quick. This is from Wikipedia in their e-learning section. A 12-year meta-analysis of research by the U.S. Department of Education find that the higher sound that students in online learning generally perform better than those in face-to-face courses. Online learning, i.e. with computers, perform better than face-to-face instruction. Times are changing, but the money is not there because they're buying textbooks.
I would add to that, not only are they buying textbooks that may not be relevant anymore, they're also spending money in frivolous programs where they could be dumping the money back into actual education. So this is probably going to be horribly controversial for many people, but I think it's a crime, an absolute travesty that schools put money into their athletic programs lots of money into their athletic programs when that should be going back into the educational program itself, giving students the computers they need to be able to perform the tasks that they need to do in school, giving them better mathematics education, better English education, or whatever language they need to learn. And I can't wait just to see the emails that come in for me saying that.
Well, unfortunately, in many schools, a lot of things are paid for through athletics because the only thing that schools tend to charge for is admission to games. And when you fill that stadium once or twice a week, you've made some money. And that money often is funneled back into educational programs.
Pat, I agree with what Jeff said, and I'm hearing what you're saying, but the issue I have with it is that the income generated off of the sports, I always hear that. And if you're a major university, and God knows I sit here in the shadow of Penn State, which generates a ridiculous amount of money through their football program, but at the same time, I have yet to see an accounting of how that balances out against the infrastructure and the costs of the programs. And I'm just not convinced it's in the black.
Well, I'm certainly not totally against sports, but it's not just sports. Across the board, I think that do we have the hearts and the minds of educators?
Don't know. Keith, how about in Australia? Obviously, you know, in the United States, sports are a big thing, and we're having our own budgetary problems. But how is education handled in Australia, and what kind of focus do you see on technology there?
So, unlike the US, sports here aren't a draw card for a university. You won't usually see someone get a scholarship because of a sporting ability or anything like that. It's the difference is quite stark. So here, a lot of what actually funds universities is external students, students from overseas who are full paying students, and that subsidizes the university, and that makes university for Australian students cheaper, essentially. And for a long time, university was completely free here, but in the last decade or so, they've gradually made it something that you have to pay back to the government over over your working life through tax. So resources don't get the same kind of bias that I can only assume in the US from watching movies and talking to US friends what it's like. But it really does seem an odd situation where somehow this one little niche, which is sport, has become this branding for an entire education facility, and it's kind of odd from my perspective. So I can't speak from any other country's perspective, but from an Australian perspective, it's quite odd. I did have an interesting story actually, going back on a previous topic, but talking about access to machines, and I don't know if anyone's read the latest book from Malcolm Gladwell, where it talks about the 10,000 hours idea. Has anyone come across that one? Yeah, Outliers, that's the one. And so one of the stories there is he talks about the basic idea is that you need 10,000 hours of anything to become an expert, becoming an expert violinist or a computer programmer. And one of the stories is about Bill Gates, who is basically a fluke that one of the people in the parents committee on his school was somehow interested in computers, and somehow they got some money together and got a terminal that would connect to the university computer nearby. So in I think it was 1968, this was very, very rare for an eighth grade. To have access to a computer. And it's speculated in this book that it's just the fact that he had access to that. And, he would sneak out at nighttime and go back to school and use the computer and then sneak back in and go back to bed. He would just be clocking up lots of hours. Obviously, he had a passion for it, but also access to it. That meant that he became, what he is today. And it's just a very interesting story to me. If he hadn't had access to that, or if someone else had access to computing facilities like that, then would there be another Bill Gates? And, I wonder if that's happening today in schools, are there a bunch of brilliant people out there missing out because all the money's going into, say, in the US, going into sport?
Eric, I'm going to put you on the spot. As a kid in Sweden, do you feel that you have adequate access to technology? And you may not be the best person to ask because you're going to go out and find it, knowing you. But do your peers have adequate access to technology if they want it?
I'd say not. In the past, I think 2 years here, computers have become a really big part of our school system. And I think in And state-driven schools, I think they have a goal in, say, 2 years, every pupil should have their own computer. And that's the major goal. It's suddenly just popped up, and it's getting funding from somewhere. I don't really know where, but as here as well, sports isn't really that big, and still school is free from kindergarten up throughout university. But I think we used to have even computer courses, at least in our school, and they've removed it because they think we're computer literate enough. But I know several of my friends who, I mean, just opening an Excel spreadsheet is a nightmare. They don't know what to do if they're asked to. And that's, and I'm still at a natural science program, so we do a lot of calculations.
You know, that's something that kind of takes us in another direction. And Jeff, maybe I'll turn to you or Julio and ask you to comment. But how about the curriculum? We've sort of been focused on hardware and on access, but are the skills that are being taught what people, kids need to learn, I guess. I don't even want to say to succeed as an adult, because by the time they become adults in the working world, things are going to have changed, you know, five times. But at this point, do you think that what they're getting is what they should be getting at this stage, some of those basic skills? And interesting that that Eric should pick Excel. Should spreadsheets be spreadsheets, word processing, desktop publishing, as Pat said, media, should they be in that curriculum?
Well, you know, my thought about technology and education, sometimes schools, like, they wheel out technology for the sake of technology, and we're going to do the technology learning now, and then they put the technology away and move on to something else. And I think that's completely the wrong approach. I think technology should permeate, you know, every facet of a kid's education, so it sort of fades into the background and becomes, you know, one of many tools. I did a story for my newspaper about a grade school that has a cart. You know, they wheel in this cart, and all of these iPod touches are in there charging, and then they sort of hand them out to the students, and the students spend 45 minutes, you know, playing educational games. Then they put the iPod touches away, and the cart goes away. And that strikes me as a little silly, and I'll compare that to another school in my area that I investigated. And that school, a teacher is giving each of the kids an iPod Touch, is a here, and now we're going to set up email accounts for all your Gmail accounts. We're going to set up Dropbox accounts for all of you people, and the technology sort of becomes an infrastructure, as it were, and it allows the students to, you know, do all of their disciplines more easily because the technology is in an enabling force. It's not there for the sake of technology. It's something that sort of lurks in the background and lets the students do things more powerfully, more effectively.
You totally just nailed on a huge problem that I have seen over and over. The number of students that are coming out of high school and college into the workforce today that have no idea how to use a computer and are not comfortable with technology on any level is it's stunning to me. It's like we had this whole generation that came through where we were all, yes, give me this technology. I can really appreciate how it can make my life better. And then following us, there's this whole generation of people that are saying things like, yeah, well, we had the Windows thing every Thursday afternoon when the cart rolled into the classroom. And they don't know how to use any of this stuff. And it's not permeating their entire education process. It's not ubiquitous. And as an example, I am so used to all this technology that as you guys started talking about outliers, which I had not heard of, I immediately did what I would have loved to have been able to do in high school and college, which is flip over to my iPad really quick, quietly type in to the iBookstore, the book name, bring everything up. There it is. It's $12.99, 4.5 stars. I can get a sample and then buy it if I want. I mean, that is so empowering. And I think we have this entire generation of people that by and large don't understand how empowering this is anymore.
Jeff, I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that because the iPod has been around for a while. I mean, there's plenty of jokes about the older folks, sorry, folks of you out there who this applies to, who couldn't program their VCRs. You know, that it was always blinking 12. And at some generation, that seemed to be almost a badge of honor. No, I can't program it. It just blinks. And yet I saw kids come in to those VCRs, and they never had any formal training on a VCR, and they could figure it out right away. So I'm intrigued as to what age group you think you're referring to.
I'm referring to people that are in their late teens through late 20s. The number of people that I've met that fall into that age bracket, and they don't even understand the difference between the operating system on their computer and the running an application, and that's just kind of scary.
I think for us, I mean, we always hear that as kids now. When I'm 18, and in my age group, we're really good at the internet, and that's really our thing. I mean, talking about kids now, it's Facebook, it's all online sites, but I think we tend to forget the computer side of things, because many don't know how to work with the computer. As long as they open the computer, they open the chat application, they open the internet, and then they can go on forever. And the same with iPods, iPhones, iPads. Everything comes more naturally when you're grown up with it. But using the computer in the old computer work with it sense is more lost, I think.
I love how you said old computer.
Well, but you know, he brings up an interesting point that most of the people on this call, with possibly the exception of Eric and maybe one or two others, you know, there is this perception that you work on a computer. Now, I don't think it applies to this group, because we all use the computer for everything. So it's work, it's play, it's recreation, it's entertainment, it's everything. But I know way too many people that I have worked with in the past who say things like, I work on a computer all day. Why would I want to go home and work on one all night? And you try to explain it to them, they just don't get it.
Well, maybe this is a case where the vision that Steve Jobs had for the computer when the original Macintosh was introduced is actually coming to fruition, which is seeing computing devices as appliances. I mean, you don't need to know how your toaster works to make toast. And you don't need to know how your iPod encodes music so that you can listen to it. And maybe this is just all the natural progression of how the technology goes, where it becomes ubiquitous in the sense that we're just so familiar with having an iPod around or an iPad where you just touch things and you're searching and you don't care if you're in an application or what that application might be. It's just that free-flowing access to information and sending it out where you need it or want it to go.
Pat, can we educate kids in technology, using technology, and not require them to be geeks like us?
Very definitely. The thing is, we have to use it as a tool, and we have to start back in kindergarten and first grade saying every child needs to know how to draw on a computer. They need to understand the concept of draw versus paint. They need to know how to type into the computer, and it doesn't necessarily have to be 10 Thumbs Typing Tutor. They need to know how to use a spreadsheet. It doesn't have to be Excel. And then once they have those tools, they need to use those tools to continue on. But too often, people think of a computer as something that teaches the kid. Instead of being like, a computer is like a pencil. So you have to get teachers to think of it as a pencil, not as a textbook.
Okay. That's the way I think of some of this technology is, and I'm looking at it from the perspective of someone in the business world who are looking for good employees. And I don't expect them to be able to do pivot tables in Excel, but I do expect them to be able to construct a basic spreadsheet. I think that's reasonable, and I'm happy to say that most of the people we see come across our paths that are out of college in the last few years seem to have those skills. But I go back to what Jeff said. I think there is a gap in there of people that are surprisingly unaware of technology and don't even realize how unaware they are of technology.
Right. Who were their teachers and what did their teachers require?
And to be fair, it may not have been a failure of the teachers or the educational system. It maybe this was just part of the evolution of computers, as Jeff said, becoming ubiquitous and achieving this place in our society, in our world.
When you talk about ubiquity of computers, I'll point you, for instance, to my son's. My son is 12. He goes to a pretty good public school. It's one of the better public schools in this region. But there's a problem with technology there. The problem is that they're all Macs. They have very nice new iMacs, but all of these iMacs are sequestered in a computer room, and my son has very limited access to that room. You know, you're herded in, you're herded out. You get an hour on the computer. Totally the wrong approach. Those computers need to be accessible at all times, so you know students can access the computers as needed. Ubiquity is the key. So I apply a different philosophy at home. I limit my son's game playing. He likes to play Rome, Total War, and things like that. But allow him unfettered access to computers for school stuff. And in fact, I'm teaching him things like Google Docs, Evernote, things that he needs to know. He already has his own domain name, his Gmail address. He's learning to collaborate with his friends. In the past, kids would sort of get together physically to work on projects together in their respective homes. But now my son can do it virtually because all of his friends are on GChat, and they just zap information back and forth electronically. It's really fun to see a 12-year-old, thriving in that kind of environment. But I'm giving him those tools. His school is not.
And see, that's what I did. I saw that my kids weren't getting it, so I went to the school to train the teachers' schools and then to turn around and train the kids. But not everybody can do that. But you've got it right there. They have to have it as a pencil.
So someone coined the term digital divide at some point. Do you think that that's what we're seeing? Do you think we're seeing the creation of this? I'm not willing to say an expansion or a contraction, but do you think that there is a digital divide here?
There's a lot of computers in schools. Are they the right computers? Is it the right technology? Do the kids have access to it? That's the key.
And I would venture to say most schools don't give their students that critical level of access to the computers. There's been this kind of recurring theme in what we've been talking about where everyone says, and then the kids get taken to the computer lab, or then the computer cart gets brought to them, and they get an hour here and there along the way. And No, that's not a pencil. That's an occasional show and tell. If you take kids to a petting zoo a couple times a year, that doesn't make them farmers.
And I'll give you an example of pencils. There's this other school here in the Twin Cities, absolutely wonderful school, and it has a completely different approach. There's a class of Windows PC that's specifically designed for kids in schools. It's called a Classmate. It's very rugged. The keyboard is sort of kid size. It runs the full Windows, but it's not very expensive. The earlier versions of this were terribly designed, but it's making great strides. The latest version isn't bad. And this school has given each kid one of these laptops, and that laptop and the kid, they're attached at all times. The kids are taking them to all their classes, using them in all their classes, using them at home. They're completely hooked on these things, and the computer has sort of become an environment for them. They no longer say to themselves, "I'm on the computer. Isn't this cool?" They're more interested in what is on the screen, what they're learning at that time, how the laptops can be hooked together in classrooms for collaboration. Anything on a kid's laptop, any kid's laptop's contents can be thrown up on a projector. And so the laptops have sort of faded into the background and sort of become an ecosystem. That is absolutely wonderful. I envy the kids in that school. I wish my son went to a school like that. It's a private school, obviously, so they have money to throw around.
Eric, Pat just said something about the right computers. They need to be the right computers. Now, we're all Mac people, and that goes without saying, so we have a bit of a bias. But do you think that it needs to be a Mac? Do you think that Apple has such an amazing lock on technology that's the absolute best choice from an educational standpoint? Let's forget affordability and let's forget maintenance. But from the teaching and learning aspect, do you think it needs to be a PC or a Mac?
Well, you're asking me who's a Mac geek and who is at a school who's all Mac. But no, I don't really think it has to be a Mac, nor really a computer. I think with all tablet devices, and of course I have to say the iPad because that's pretty much the only capable tablet device out there right now, I think you can use in school the iPad for a lot of the things you need. And I'm eagerly awaiting my iPad later this week, so I'm going to be interested to see how this works in school. But I mean, if I bring a wireless keyboard and my iPad, I could potentially sit there and take notes in all my classes, and math and drawing type classes. I could just use my hands on the touchscreen, and that prevents me from having to lug my computer around all day, which is heavy.
Okay, now we got to have some fun with that.
Okay, now the books thing, I want to jump on that and the heavy thing. Back in my day when we didn't have cart around because it was all dumb terminals connected to mainframes and green bar paper, the number of people that I knew with back injuries from having to cart around 50 pounds of books, and I'm not kidding, on their backs for other classes, that was just horrendous. I would have loved to have had the type of technology we have today and to have had those books electronically so that I could carry all of my materials around in one small package, as opposed to 50 pounds of books on my back every day to every class.
And you know, that would be a dream of mine, because right now I'm carrying not only my laptop, but of course all these books as well. So once they get digital, I'm going to be very happy.
Unfortunately, a lot of people can make fun of that, and there are going to be a few listeners who are going to say, "Yeah, well, in my day, you know, we carried 100 pounds of books uphill in the snow both ways,
and barefoot.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot that one.
and every night we'd go home, and our dad would whip us to death and sing Glory Hallelujah as he danced around our graves.
But there is a certain amount of truth to it. Now let's shift into the modern age and talk about all us iPad owners who are carrying around 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 100 books in our iPads, or maybe not quite that many in our iPhones, through the iTunes store, have access to that. It does change the dynamic of learning. It changes the accessibility so that I don't have to decide whether I want to carry a book home from school if I didn't really need to. I've got everything right there so I can explore if I opt to. And I think that just having that access changes things.
I love, just to give a couple of examples, I love, for instance, Google Reader, because I can sort of jack into, you know, all the websites that give me useful and enlightening information and have information from those websites collected in one place. And Google Reader's in the cloud, so I can access it, you know, via NetNewsWire on a Mac or via Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R, Reader on the iPad. And Amazon eBooks is another amazing example, because the Amazon has made it possible for Kindle books to be read on any device. So I can literally, in the evening, start a book in bed on the iPad, then later, you know, read a little bit on a computer during the day. When I'm on the bus, I can keep working on the book on an Android phone or an iPhone. And the devices almost fade into the background. I'm just picking away at a book no matter where I am, and that kind of ubiquity in my adult learning is something that needs to occur in education. It's not quite there. That sort of system hasn't been put into place at most schools.
Keith, from a developer standpoint, how important is the education market? Now, I know that it's going to depend on what kind of developer you are to some degree, but I see more and more, I've seen a lot of back-to-school sales from a lot of products that I wouldn't have necessarily thought about from a back-to-school perspective, and I realize that that's my own bias. Now, admittedly, some of them are just jumping on the bandwagon, but I also see a lot of interesting tools out there that I stop and think, you know, a student could use that very easily and very effectively, and I hadn't considered that before. So where does the educational picture fit in with a developer of anything?
I think it's really increasingly important. Because how do I put it? As these devices get more and more reliable and the interface becomes less and less of a hurdle, basically the software means that kids can do more and more amazing things. So like an iPad these days, you can put a whole recording studio on that thing. It's just like it's mind blowing, and the interface is so easy to use that a kid can sit there and do a, you know, 16-track record, you know, as part of a class project. And I think that opens up a whole market to a whole bunch of software developers, because before then, you wouldn't be able to build such sophisticated things and expect a kid to be able to use them, but. The sophistication and the maturity of these platforms now means that you can build software that is really quite sophisticated and does really professional has really professional output, but at the same time it's readily accessible to anybody. You know, I mean, the whole iOS market, you basically think about pitching it, you know, building an app and pitching that to the you know, Joe Smith, everyday man, grandma, whatever. You're trying to make sure anybody can use it, and that means that at the general public gets to use it, but it also means that kids can use it because it's now available to them. So I think there's just a wealth of opportunities to build general purpose applications that now can be used in education, and let kids, you know, record albums, make movies, you know, animate a cartoon, you know, do little physics science experiments using little, you know, mathematical models. All this kind of stuff is now readily available to kids.
So it sounds like you think it's a pretty rich market out there, or potential market, from a business standpoint and from an influence standpoint. If you're doing something that can be used in the educational system or in the educational process, you can really make a difference in the world today.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's always been the driving factor for a lot of software developers who work in the education field, because it's not the easiest thing to manage, because you know you're not selling directly to a consumer. You have to deal with a region or a state or, you know, county when you're invoicing them and all this kind of stuff, and they have special needs, and so that means often you need to go through an education publisher. So there have been a few extra layers to make that more difficult, but. And I don't know how schools are doing this, but potentially now you could just release an app on the App Store, for example. And if a school wants it, they just buy 30 of them for whatever it costs, you know, $4 or whatever it is. And suddenly a lot of what was in the way before isn't. And also the devices mean that you can build something that will be usable for a general public and also usable for the education market.
Folks, before we run out of time, I did want to go around the table and ask everyone to comment on a product or two that they think should be recommended to parents, to teachers, to anyone out there in the educational process. It can be hardware, it can be software, doesn't matter. Whatever you think is most important or unusual or fits with your particular perspective on the education question. And Pat, I'll sort of go the same route we did before. I'll start with you.
Well, if I had won a grant today for school, I would definitely say every kid in the school needs an iPad. And as for software, content creation software, things that they can use to do something with what they've learned, to reproduce Google Docs, the iWork apps, things that produce.
Okay. Keith?
Interesting question, Chuck. So there's a couple of programs that I've come across a number of times when I've been in schools doing user testing and research and just chatting to the teachers and kids. And they've come up again and again. And they're desktop apps, so maybe they're not representing the future, but they're definitely used a lot. One is called Toon Boom Studio. That's TOONBOOM Studio.
What a fun app.
Yeah, as Pat was saying, it's all about content creation, and it's an animation package for kids, and I see that used a lot. And similarly, my second one is quite similar as well. It's by Boinx Software, BOINX. It's called iStop Motion, and both of these have been around a while, but they're just real mainstays in the schools that I've visited, and that one lets you build stop motion animation where you have a little bus, for example, a little toy bus, and then you move it a little bit and you take another picture, move it a little bit, take another picture. And it just seems to really appeal to kids because they're so used to animation and seeing animation. And it gives them complete freedom to tell whatever stories they want, do whatever visual things they want. And these tools, I think, are really, really exciting. So, and I don't know what the iPad or iPhone equivalents are. I haven't really looked into that, and I'm sure there are some. But I really like this genre of application.
Julio?
Well, in an ideal world, a parent would equip a kid going to college with a MacBook Pro, an iPad, and an iPhone. But just imagine the cost. Most parents can't shoulder that cost. So certain compromises need to be made. And, there are interesting alternate approaches you can take. For instance, I'm fascinated by the fact that the iPhone's iOS 4 now has a Bluetooth keyboard support. So here's what a student can do. The student doesn't have has a laptop, has the iPhone, does not have an iPad. But if you're in class, you can connect a Matthias, I think it's Matthias, a folding keyboard or Apple's wireless keyboard. You can connect that to the iPhone and take notes in class on the iPhone. You can use Simple Note. The Simple Note app, syncs everything to the cloud. Once the student gets back to his or her laptop, it pulls right down in notational velocity. For parents that can't buy everything for their kids, the iPhone can be a good, highly portable device that works, very well in the classroom. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. The first time I got in my hands a device with iOS 4, and I had that keyboard compatibility, it suddenly dawned on me that I had a really old Think Outside folding keyboard that I had used. I think either a Windows mobile device or a Palm PDA, one of those. But anyway, it was this folding keyboard that had it. It was a Bluetooth keyboard. And I said, I wonder if I pull out this keyboard and unfold it, and will it link to my iPhone? And it worked brilliantly, and it has the little cradle for the device, so the iPhone sits in there at exactly the right angle, and it works brilliantly. And then when I'm done, I just fold it up and stick it in my backpack. And I in many cases, I don't need an iPad. I can just carry this teeny tiny little keyboard that folds up. The iPhone's in my pocket, and I don't even need to carry a bag.
Okay, that sounds like something to aspire to. I'm a little hesitant to unleash Jeff Gammon's recommendations on the youth of the planet, but go for it, Jeff. Let's see what happens.
Actually, you'd be really surprised, I think, because I put a lot of time into thinking about what I would recommend. And so my recommendations are based on just how incredibly useful having an iPad with you all the time is. So I have a bunch of iPad recommendations. And the first would be to get iWork so that you can create all the reports that look better than everyone else's. And then you'll be able to do your presentations because you'll have Keynote. And at some point, you're going to need to make a spreadsheet, so you'll have numbers. And then the Wolfram application, which is fantastic for doing research. And if you don't know how to do research in school, you're going to be kind of screwed. So it's a great tool for helping with that. And we've already mentioned SimpleNote, so I won't include that again. But then Dropbox and Instapaper, so that you can tag articles and websites as you're doing your research. That's what Instapaper will do for you. And then having a Dropbox account means you're going to be able to more easily get the content that you're working on back and forth between your iPad and whatever other computer you're going to work with. And then you should also have something so that it's easier to keep track of all this information that you're trying to aggregate for your studies. So Reader for the iPad. I'm going to toss that in there too.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yes.
That's quite a collection, Jeff, and that's a really good collection.
And I actually trimmed it way down from what I was going to suggest originally.
And that's a really fantastic list, and I want to throw in an alternate option. Instapaper has a competitor called Read It Later, which takes a more graphical magazine approach like to the articles and sites that you've clipped. I really like it. Instapaper and Read It Later essentially do the same things in slightly different ways, and each has its ardent fans. I'm kind of on the Read It Later side, but Instapaper is really good too.
Okay, now we get the voice of authority, because Eric is in school. Eric is a geek. Eric has to make some decisions about what he can take and what he wants and what's useful. Eric, enlighten us. What should people be looking at?
Well, you guys have already taken most of the really good ones, but I think the productivity bit is lacking here. So I'm going to recommend two apps on my iPhone as well as my Mac that I use daily and that I pretty much can't live without. So the first is Things, which is my to-do list of choice. It's on the Mac, it's on the iPhone and the iPad. Works really well, try to keep track of my homework and my other stuff as well. And together with that comes, of course, iCal. I couldn't do it without my calendar with my schedule and everything in there. So that's my two picks. And while I'm thinking about it, I'm going to throw in a final one, and that's backing up all my school reports, because that's something you can usually forget. So I'm going to throw in my favorite service, which is Mosey, an online backup service.
Good for you. Good for you. You got backups in there. And you stole one of mine, because I didn't expect anyone to pick it, Eric, and that is I would have said BusyCal as opposed to iCal, but a calendaring option of some kind, because that'll help the students keep track of all their commitments, all their requirements, you know, social events, everything. It's all there so you don't miss it. And I think that really is something that I think a lot of business people could use, but that's a whole other discussion. one other plug I want to throw in, though, Chris Breen had an outstanding Macworld podcast as we record this. I believe it was released last week, and I hope I get the gentleman's name right. Dr. Bill Wecking from the Hawaii Preparatory Academy's Energy Lab. The podcast is billed as Apple and Sustainable Living, but it has at least as much, if not more, to do with the educational system and technology and ways of implementing technology in education. And so I will have a link in the show notes. If you're an educator or if you're interested in this, folks, I'm telling you, this is a must listen. It is really, really, really good. I'm the only thing I don't like about it is I'm jealous of Chris for finding this gentleman first because he did a really good job. All right. Any final thoughts on education and school, back to school tech for the good of the order?
As a parent, I would say I would stress it's incumbent on parents to be to educate themselves about technology so they can pass that knowledge onto their kids, because they shouldn't assume that the school will do, you know, all the work for them. That's classical advice. It's always been the case, but you know, it applies just as well in the technology sphere. Learn technology, teach your kids technology. You really be involved with your kids because you and the schools have to work together to prepare your kids for the future. It's very important.
This topic is just a mind-blowing one to me, because we in this sitting in our, you know, virtual room here and chatting represent a couple of generations who have not how do I put this? There's never been a time in history like this before that the average person can have a device in their pocket that they can look up literally anything they want to know. I mean, maybe they won't be able to look up broad, you know, abstract concepts, but in terms of, you know, historical data or how to do something or a tutorial or any kind of, you know, just raw data, they can have access to it in seconds. There must be a revolution about to happen. I just think it's a really exciting time. It's a really great opportunity to empower our kids to become world leaders. Because I know just quickly, a short story, but I've starting up a little startups group here locally, and you know, meeting with various entrepreneurial kind of people. And I have to say, there's some people who, you know, they weren't familiar what a Google group was, for example. They didn't understand the idea of a mailing list. And, you know, these were people who are aspiring to be entrepreneurs, essentially. And to me, I can't stand that. They're like, that seems like they don't have the lingua franca of business. If they don't understand technology, like, so if they speak another language, English is a second language, that's fine to me. If their English is very poor and English is kind of the lingua franca of business, but that I completely understand. I deal with people all day who English is a second language, but if they don't understand the technology or the basic concepts of it, then they're not involved in the community. They just don't have a chance. And I think it's such an important time for us to really rethink. You know, do we need a room full of dead trees? Do we need, you know, how about we just demolish the library and hand everyone iPads? You know, it's just a revolutionary time.
So, okay, so right now we are in what can be a revolutionary time with information, both just on a personal level and on an educational level. And the people that learn how to use this information and use it effectively are going to be the people that really succeed moving forward. So for the students that are in schools where they have access to really be able to take advantage of what's available today, those are the kids that are going to have the advantage. And I wish everyone could be in an environment like that. And I know I'm usually the guy that's cracking all the funny jokes, or at least jokes, through podcasts. But like, I'm really serious right now. This is an amazing time. And the people that get that and run with it are going to be so incredibly successful. And yeah, they will be our future leaders, and hopefully they'll be the right future leaders.
Never in the history of computing have we had a device that essentially required no teaching to teach someone how to use it. I've seen 18-month-olds use it. I've seen 92-year-olds use the iPad. I think it's definitely a device to change the world. I know that there are going to be competitors coming online, and I know that school districts who hate Apple are going to buy any other product that they can if the world comes down that we need these tablet devices. But I hope schools get it, that this is a time that we can really change education for the better. And it's not that expensive.
Eric, anything?
Well, I'll just close off my statement by just saying, well, we know what to do now, so let's just go ahead and do it.
That sounds like
you rock.
You do. That sounds like a young person's perspective. That's terrific. That's a great statement. I want to throw in just one last thing. This year, for some reason, I've known a number of kids who have graduated from high school. They're headed to college. But I would say this to anyone of any age that is so inclined. Jeff, I was really, really impressed by the seriousness and the wisdom of your statements. I want to twist it just a little bit, though. I think one of the things that is missing from educational systems everywhere is the important message that, and we all know this, that learning is fun. It just is. And so any technology you can put in a kid's hands, kids, any technology you can get that facilitates you learning about whatever it is you want to learn about, I don't care what it is got to be a good thing, because that will dovetail in with what Jeff said about being successful. You know, you don't have to be successful in business or the graphic arts or music or whatever. Find what you love, learn about it, and go for it. And you will have a great time. You really will. Guys, this has been one of the best Mac juries I think we may have ever had. Thank you very much to Keith Lang, Pat Falkay, Julio Jose de Zapata, Jeff Gamet, and Eric Bernskield. Really appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Thanks, Chuck.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun.
Thank you.
I'm Chuck Joyner. I'm not sure if the verdict is in, but we certainly had a lot of evidence put in this time on this Mac jury. Please check the show notes. I'll have links in to all the products we recommended, to the podcast I mentioned, and certainly to everything that our esteemed jurors do in their daily lives. Until the next time, thanks for listening. The Mac Jury is part of the Mac Voices Group and a member of Mac Level 10.